I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today for The American Idea. I am Kara Rogers Stevens, and I'm happy to join The American Idea along with Professor Jeff Sickinga as one of the show's hosts. I am an associate professor of history here at Ashland University, and I also work with Jeff in our Ashbrook program. I'm one of the co-directors of the Scholar program for our undergraduate students, and I also get to teach in our master's degree program and for our Teaching American History seminars. I specialize in the history of Thomas Jefferson, in particular in the areas of race, slavery, and abolition here in America. But I'm also fascinated by American political and intellectual history more broadly, from the area of the colonies all the way through modern day. I recently published a book about Thomas Jefferson and the fight against slavery. And it is one of my favorite topics to talk about. I am a bit of a Jefferson fan, but I am also a Jefferson critic, and I'm a fan of many of the other founders, including Alexander Hamilton and John Adams, who Thomas Jefferson wasn't always very fond of. And I am honored to be joined today by somebody who is also a fan of John Adams and even Alexander Hamilton. My husband, another professor of history here at Ashland University, Jason Stevens. Jason, thank you so much for coming on the show to talk with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
And today, Jason and I are going to have the pleasure of talking about something very relevant to our current day, the election of 1800. As everybody knows, we're in an election season here in the United States. We're counting down the days until hopefully there is a peaceful and uneventful process and a transfer of power, whether that is from one president to the next or one party to the next. Many people might be feeling the tension at the moment, might be feeling some anxiety, some concern about the future of the republic. The language around this election has been particularly heated. There's even been some violence. And many Americans might be feeling as though we're facing an unprecedented moment for America. And it's at times like this that I find solace by going back to the election of 1800. If you think American politics are nasty now, wait till you hear some of the things we're going to talk about today. The election of 1800, just to set the stage a little bit, it was the first election where Americans were needing to choose between two very different political parties. The party of the Federalists, represented by President John Adams, and then, of course, Alexander Hamilton is perhaps the most famous thinker associated with that party. And then on the other side, the vice president, Thomas Jefferson, running against his president, John Adams. And Thomas Jefferson represented the Democratic-Republican Party. Now, these two parties don't exactly correspond to the political parties that we have today, but they certainly had different visions for the future of America. And things in 1800 were extremely tense. Jason, do you want to say anything about this tense atmosphere and these two different parties that are at each other's throats in this particular election?
Yeah, absolutely. And I also agree with your earlier point, Kara, that we can find solace, as you said, in our study of American history when thinking about our own times. I would also add that I not only find solace, but I also find hope when I go back to our past and see the struggles and the controversies that Americans have overcome in our past. It puts our own times and our own struggles in perspective. We may think that the rhetoric, the tone of the modern political campaign, the verbal missives that are hurled back and forth between the parties today, we may think to ourselves, well, it's never been worse. When I study the election of 1800, it is very obvious. No, it has been worse. Same thing when I studied the election of 1860. No, it has been worse.
Oh, right? That's a great point.
Right, right. I mean, look, in the election of 1800, as you're already very clearly laid out for us, there's something new going on, not just in American history, but also in terms of human history.
That's a fantastic
in the election
point.
Of 1800.
That's right. There had never been a republic where there was an election that with the potential for a peaceful transfer of power from one political party to the next political party. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So this is why some have come to call the election of 1800 the revolution of 1800, because for the first time in human history, you had the peaceful transfer of power from one party to the opposition party without a drop of blood being spilled. It was a bloodless revolution, but a revolution nonetheless, because such a thing had never happened before in the history of the world. And it happens for the first time here in America following the election of 1800, where John Adams and his Federalist Party peacefully step aside to allow the transfer of power to the opposition party. As you mentioned, Thomas Jefferson and his Democratic Republicans. And although Jefferson and Adams at times in their lives were best friends, they helped to co-author the Declaration of Independence. In the election of 1800, there are fierce differences between these two rival parties. And the kind of tone of the campaign of 1800 was much worse than anything that we've experienced in our lifetimes. And I use the word campaign there loosely because, right, they didn't, in fact, during the early Republic, they didn't campaign the way that they do now, where the candidates are out on the stump and constantly giving speeches.
They wouldn't have gone door to door. They wouldn't have, although I will say the scumbag Aaron Burr was a part of the election of 1800, and he did actually go door to door trying to rustle up votes. He is known for transforming American politics in that way. He will be a loser in the election of 1800, but we'll get back to him. So you were saying the election was run differently. The people who are running for office, they were kind of expected to stay above the fray and not get involved in the down and dirty, but that didn't stop their seconds in command and those who supported them from being really nasty. And the attack ads that these two political parties ran against the other, you know, the opposition candidates rival anything that we see today, don't you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you're right. You know, it's not the actual candidates going out door to door, but their surrogates are certainly making the case on their behalf. And part of that task is attacking the other party. And so each party at this time had already developed sort of these vast and well-read newspapers, right, that were run by the party, supported the party's positions, and moreover, attacked the other guy. And so although Thomas Jefferson and John Adams aren't out there, right, making stump speeches, their supporters certainly are saying a lot that really, in comparison to what we hear today, makes our modern campaign seem, as I said, tamed by comparison. In fact,
yeah, that's right.
A lot of what was being said back in the election of 1800, we can't even repeat on air in this format. I mean, the vast majority of the things that were said on a regular basis or appeared in print, we could not, just because of our audience, because of our format here, we simply can't repeat a lot of this stuff. If you want to find out for yourself, maybe do an online search for this. I think we could talk maybe about some of the more tame aspects.
Yeah, we have to give people an idea of what
we
got to
give them an
said.
Idea. So yeah,
so
please.
For example, let's see. One of the insults against Thomas Jefferson was that if there was this genuine fear and kind of a rumor going around that Jefferson was an atheist. Jefferson was known for supporting the French Revolution, and by this point, the revolution had gotten pretty radical. And so by association, Jefferson was assumed to also be that level of radical and an atheist who would be an enemy of any Christian person in America. So Jefferson's enemies said things like, if Jefferson wins the election, babies will be killed on pikes, Bibles will be burned in the street, chastity will be violated. Essentially, morality will collapse if this man is elected president. And those who attacked John Adams on Thomas Jefferson's behalf had some equally vile things to say against him. Now, maybe you can remember some of the personal insults, but I'll just read a Jefferson letter where he kind of summarized some of his concerns about the Federalist Party in general. He wrote to a friend of his, quote, "A monarchical and aristocratical party has sprung up, whose avowed object is to draw over us the substance, as they have already done, the forms of the British government." In other words, Jefferson and his party feared that Adams secretly wanted to be king, that there was a Federalist conspiracy to transform the format of the government, that we were headed back toward the exact thing that we had just fought a revolution to be free of, that the Republic was in danger if Adams continued to hold on to power. What other kinds of insults? Do you remember any other nasty things about Adams that we can repeat?
Yeah, some of the tamer things that we can actually say on air. I mean, they attacked his physical appearance, right? They called him blind, bald, and toothless. I mean, there's one source that hurls the accusation that he's hermaphroditical or hermaphrodite, and that really, really riled Abigail Adams. To see those kind of things about her husband appear in print. But again, those were the tamer aspects of it.
Yeah.
This was a vile and vicious campaign. And one other thing I'll say, I know there were reports that appeared in Federalist newspapers at the end of the 1790s really explained just how much the election was affecting every facet of life, as we might sometimes see in our own day today.
Yeah.
These newspaper accounts explained like gentlemen refusing to top their hats to each other, and they would cross the street and go to the other side of the street in order to avoid walking by those whom they disagreed with. Right. Today, that seems like, well, okay, that's not a big deal. That seems like a little thing. But back then, that was a huge thing, right? Because it was like an honor code. Right. That would be cause for maybe a calling for a duel if somebody refuses to top their hat to you and intentionally walks to the other side of the street, basically saying, I refuse to associate with you, to be anywhere near you, because your political opinions are so distasteful to me. Those were grounds of breaking the honor code and perhaps calling for a duel. And so it was quite divisive.
And it wasn't entirely, I mean, you mentioned kind of the threat of violence. There were actual riots in the streets, and this is pre-Secret Service. So there were riots that went right up to President John Adams's door, and he didn't have official protection the way that we think of it today, which helps explain the tensions that were felt, and even some of what we now consider to be the Federalist government's overreach in terms of the Alien and Sedition Acts that had been passed in the 1798, that there were, much like today, there were fears about immigrants coming in and messing up the election. So there was a law passed to make it more difficult for immigrants to vote because of these fears of radicals from France and from Ireland even coming in and distorting the political process. There were concerns about the political rhetoric becoming so overheated and so much misinformation being spread about the government, that the Federalists actually passed a sedition law that made it illegal to criticize John Adams or the Federalist government. And 20 different Democratic Republicans were imprisoned under these laws, mostly people who worked as newspaper editors for Thomas Jefferson's political party, for the Democratic Republican Party. 20 people were put in prison. One of them, all he said was, I'm going to give a great quote here, "President Adams has a, quote, unbounded thirst for ridiculous pomp, foolish adulation, and self-avarice." That was considered to be beyond the pale, unacceptable political speech. And so this man was thrown in prison. This was Matthew Lyon of Vermont. So you know, in many ways, we look back and we think, my gosh, they were overreacting. They were restricting free speech. But even today, we have concerns about free speech and what is hate speech and what is acceptable criticism of the government and what crosses the line. And this is not a new problem for Americans to face. We worry now about a politically biased media, as you mentioned. Back then, it wasn't just Fox News versus MSNBC giving different versions of the story. The different newspapers in America literally represented the different political parties and wrote whatever those political parties told them to say. And people had concerns about that. There were concerns about a foreign invasion. There were tensions with France and concerns about how America needed to defend itself. So many of the same things that we worry about in our current political moment in this election, Americans were facing the same worries in 1800.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. And you're absolutely right. John Adams and the Federalists, they didn't do themselves any political favors by passing the Alien and Sedition Acts. And then, of course, in the election of 1800, John Adams ends up coming in third, as you mentioned at the top of our program, right? It's a tie between two Democratic Republicans, between Jefferson and Aaron Burr.
What the heck? How did that happen, Dr. Stevens?
Yeah, so the Electoral College, it has since been amended, but when it was originally in the Constitution under Article 2, the winner of the Electoral College would become the president. The runner-up would become the vice president. But this was written during a time prior to the rise of political parties in the United States. So with the rise
of George Washington
parties,
was the unanimous candidate. Everybody knew he was going to be elected. In our first couple of elections, there was no problem with the Electoral College. It worked just fine. But then you're so right. As this opposition party rises up, now there's this concern. Well, what do we do with the Electoral College? So sorry, you were in the middle of a great explanation.
That's good information to have. And so So when the Electoral College meets, one of the electors was supposed to throw his vote, so that Jefferson would come in first, Aaron Burr would come in second, and then it would be Jefferson as president and Burr as vice president. But that didn't happen, and so it ends up being a tie in the Electoral College between Jefferson and Burr. And according to the Constitution, when there's a tie, it goes to the House of Representatives, where the House will decide, and each state will have one vote. Well, it turns out, because it goes to the House, the Federalists, who control the House, end up being able to decide, well, who will be president among these two Democratic Republicans? Because John Adams comes in third, right? It seems clear he's not going to be reelected. But now the Federalists have this choice between, well, should it be Jefferson or should it be Burr?
Yeah. And Jefferson and Burr, they're tied with 73 electoral votes each. Adams got 65. Pinckney, the other Federalist who was running for vice president, he got 64. So it was clear who was in third and fourth position, but there is this tie for first place. And so the House of Representatives gets to vote for this. And didn't it take them 9 days to go through this process of voting? Yeah. They voted 36 times.
They only break the tie, which, by the way, Burr was supposed to have conceded, but when there was a tie, he refuses to concede, and Jefferson didn't like that, kind of took that personally. Yeah.
As I mentioned, Burr is a scumbag. He really should have stepped aside. He knew he was running for vice president, but when there was this tie, he took advantage of this moment to say, well, maybe I would be a good president.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
So there's this famous letter from Alexander Hamilton where he basically lays out that he disagrees with Jefferson over every single political issue there is. They have very different principles, but Hamilton says of Jefferson, well, at least he has principles, right? Burr, you don't know what he's going to do at any time on any issue because, right, he has no political principles. He'll do whatever is advantageous for Aaron Burr.
Yeah, so, the exact quote is, Mr. Burr loves nothing but himself, thinks of nothing but his own aggrandizement, and will be content with nothing short of permanent political power in his own hands. Mr. Jefferson, I suspect, will not dare much. Mr. Burr will dare everything.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
So Hamilton actually, even though Hamilton and Jefferson are, you know, longtime political enemies, Hamilton actually chooses to support Jefferson over Burr.
That's right. Yeah, for the reasons you laid out from that document, from that original primary source. And the Federalists, they extract certain promises from Jefferson, that he would honor the national debt, that he wouldn't overturn Hamilton's financial plan, that he wouldn't, right, all of a sudden kick out all the Federalists from every federal office. And so with that being agreed to, then the House votes for Jefferson for president, and Burr then for vice president. So you've come to the end of a highly contentious political campaign, one that ended up tied, thrown to the House of Representatives. There'll be this constitutional question, well, how do we avoid that happening again? Then you get the 12th Amendment, which changes the way that the electors cast their votes, so that, right, it'll be less likely to have a tie. But there's also the issue of, we need to reunify the country.
That's right.
That we have, right, we have had this highly contentious election, but now that it's now finally over, well, now what are we to do? And Jefferson takes this attitude, which is expressed in his first inaugural address, that we all now need to come together, not as Federalists, not as Democratic Republicans, but as Americans. And Jefferson's inaugural address, I mean, it ranks, his first one, it ranks right up there with Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural, with Abraham Lincoln's first inaugural. In fact, I think the stakes are very, very high in 1800, as they were in 1860 or in 1861. Oh,
that's high praise coming from you. I know that Abraham Lincoln to you is the greatest American president. Would that be fair assessment?
That would be fair to say, I guess. Sure.
But you would rank Jefferson's first inaugural address up there with some of Lincoln's speeches. Why do you place such importance on this particular document? And I should mention, Jefferson was a lousy public speaker. Apparently, when he gave this inaugural address, hardly anybody could hear him because he spoke so softly. So he's not exactly known for his public speaking skills. Why is this first inaugural so important and so memorable?
Yeah, you're right. He wasn't known as a great orator, but Jefferson was an astute politician and a prudent statesman. And George Washington, let me put it to you this way. George Washington set a lot of precedents in his time when he was president, right, stepping away after two terms, for instance. But Jefferson's first inaugural sets a precedent of its own, right? Because this begins the standard of presidents using the inauguration, specifically their inaugural address, to try to reunify the country after a contentious election. And so if we could just go to the document, there's, right, this great part. There's several great parts, but one I want to focus on for our purposes here about reunifying the country, right? He says, we are all Republicans. We are all Federalists.
Yeah.
And just a couple of lines before that, he says, every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. We have called by different names, brethren of the same principle. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists.
So he's kind of calling on Americans to consider what are the things that really we do have in common, even though we have these disagreements about perhaps different policy issues. What are the areas in which we are all Republican, we are all Federalist?
Yeah, but if you read between the lines here a little bit, right, he says every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. Doesn't that also mean, well, then maybe there are some differences of opinion that are differences of principle.
Yes, absolutely.
And which ones are those? And by the way, what's the difference between an opinion and a principle?
Well,
how do we tell the difference?
Yeah, well, I love Jefferson here. Even though he is reaching across the aisle, so to speak, he is using this language of unity. He's downplaying difference. Mm-hmm. He is not arguing that we all agree or that we're all right. If we keep reading a few lines further in that speech, one of my favorite arguments in favor of free speech is made here by Jefferson. He says, "If there be any among us who would wish to dissolve this union or to change its republican form," remember, he's worried that the Federalists secretly want to change us back to a monarchy. "So if there are those who wish to change the republican form, let them stand undisturbed as monuments of the safety with which error of opinion may be tolerated where reason is left free to combat it." I love that mental image. You can be an idiot. You can be wrong. You can have the wrong political principles, the wrong opinions. In America, you are safe to be that person and have those views. You are a monument to the safety with which error of opinion or even principle may be tolerated so long as reason is left free to combat that error. Jefferson has such faith that if people are left alone to reason with one another, to use their free speech to debate ideas, the truth will win in the end. And that's, I think, one of the bedrock principles of Jeffersonianism and still that is of vital importance to the continuation of the Republic.
Yeah, that's very, very well said. And I'll just add to that, speaking of political rivals, what Thomas Jefferson says there in the first inaugural, the part that you just quoted from, I think Alexander Hamilton would agree. In fact, we see him agreeing when you go back to Federalist number one. Number one, where Hamilton, writing as Publius, right, talks about the importance of reflection and choice versus accident and force when it comes to the formation of our political constitutions, that it seems to have been reserved to the people of this country to decide the important question for themselves, whether human beings are really capable or not of establishing good government from reflection and choice, or whether they are forever destined to depend for their political constitutions on accident and force. And when I read that from Hamilton, or when I read this first inaugural address from Jefferson, that really does provide me with a sense of hope for our current political problems, because right, even when you have these tense campaigns, right, this very intense rhetoric being used, you have highly contentious elections and people fighting back and forth with each other. Even at its worst, that kind of campaigning, that kind of rhetoric, even at its worst, is still a product of reflection and choice. We haven't yet gone back to, right, the laws of the jungle and accident and force. In other words, at least we're not killing ourselves.
Yeah, that's a really great point. We haven't gotten to 1860, in other words. And perhaps that's the one moment where force was needed in order to make the results of an election clear.
That'll be another test. Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. Although even then, the principles of the Republic and the force of law were very much central to the Civil War, despite the violence involved there. But that's a topic for a different podcast.
Yeah.
Going back to what you're talking about here, I have to give another shout out to a great Jefferson quote, because if I was a Federalist in 1801, listening to Jefferson giving this inaugural address, I might be nervous. And given the heated political rhetoric, the sorts of accusations that were flying around, the paranoia, quite frankly, that a lot of Americans had about their political enemies, there was a genuine concern that Jefferson was a threat to good morality, that he was a threat to religious freedom in some ways, that he was a threat to the continuation of the Republic. And some Federalists maybe could even have supposed that Jefferson might enact the same sorts of principles the same sorts of policies against them restricting their free speech that the Federalists had enacted on Jefferson's supporters with the sedition law. So Jefferson, in his inaugural address has the opportunity to reassure his political opponents that he would not be coming after them. And I think that he does that with this beautiful sentence: all too will bear in mind this sacred principle, that though the will of the majority is in all cases to prevail, that will, to be rightful, must be reasonable. And he continues to say, we also have to bear in mind the sacred principle that the minority possess their equal rights, which equal law must protect, and to violate would be oppression. So he's simultaneously affirming, in America, the majority wins. We have to respect majority decisions, but the majority can't do whatever they want. There is a principle of justice, of reason, that needs to be applied to these majority decisions, that if they are going to be right decisions, they must be reasonable and they must respect the equal rights of the minority. And you don't lose your rights just because your party loses an election. And this is a great principle that Jefferson sets up, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, it's a Declaration of Independence principle, right? The Declaration says the same thing, which of course is makes sense, since Jefferson was the primary author of the Declaration. Yeah. Of independence.
And he is the one who calls this election the Revolution of 1800. So you think that he's kind of, this is Revolution 2.0, where he's restoring the principles of the Declaration of Independence through this speech?
I'm not sure if he called it a revolution. Maybe. You're the Jefferson expert. You would know,
I believe he did,
about that better than I would. But nonetheless, I think Jefferson is also very, very successful in reunifying the country, right? Yeah. Not just as a result of his inaugural address, but also as a result of his presidency and what will come after that. Because at this point, the Federalists don't know it yet, but they're essentially done as a political party, right? Because, right, the next several presidents, I mean, Jefferson will serve two terms, Madison will serve two terms, Monroe will serve two terms. There's a little resurgence there with John Quincy Adams. But, I mean, the Federalists are essentially done at this point. And there will be one party ruled, and that rule will be by the Jefferson's Democratic Republicans.
Yeah. And we have to give John Adams credit here. He, at the end of his term in office, an extremely challenging term, he sacrificed, you could argue, some of his own political capital with the Federalists by making sure to negotiate a peace with France. And there was a lot of eagerness among kind of the more radicals in his own party for war. And Adams knew that that was not in the best interests of America, that we weren't ready for that sort of conflict yet. And he made sure, I think that's perhaps his greatest disinterested, to use an old-fashioned term, most noble act as a statesman is that he ensured peace with France. And he lost the election. He was pretty unpopular by the end of that one term that he had in office. And that was pretty hurtful to him personally. I think presidents who don't get reelected can take it really personally, and Adams certainly did. But looking back on him, despite the fact that we now condemn the Sedition Act in particular and some of those other of the Alien and as mistakes by his party, Adams himself, there is so much to admire in him as a president. And of course, when Thomas Jefferson gave this inaugural address, Adams was not there. Adams went home in the middle of the night. He did not stick around Washington to witness the peaceful transfer of power. And he didn't speak to Jefferson for more than a decade. These two men, their relationship totally shut down because of the bitterness of this conflict. But we also have to give Adams credit for, in the end, after he was reached out to by an intermediary, a friend of both of Jefferson and Adams, Adams sent the first letter. He reached out to Jefferson with some New Year's greetings, and this opened up years of correspondence between Jefferson and Adams. And Adams said to Jefferson, "You and I ought not to die without explaining ourselves to one another." And so in the end, these two founders give us an example of how even the most bitter of political foes can reconcile, can attempt to find common principles. They might not share every opinion, but in the end, they're both Americans. And they give us such a great example of how we can overcome our political differences and restore as Jefferson says, restore to social intercourse that harmony and affection without which liberty and even life itself are but dreary things. Without social harmony, without some affection, it is not fun to live in a free country if we're just all tearing one another apart all of the time.
That is a great reminder. That is a very timely reminder. And I won't even attempt to add to it except to say or repeat what has already been said, that right, when we study American history, when we study the great statesmen of our past and the great documents of our history, we find a lot of hope.
Yeah.
For our present times.
That is really reassuring. Hopefully, here in a few weeks, we can think back over Thomas Jefferson's wise words to us and look forward to the return of harmony and affection in our republic. Well, Dr. Stevens, is there anything else that we should say before we close out at today's podcast?
No, I'll just, again, thank you, and I was very happy to be here. Thanks for having me, and I hope you guys will invite me back again sometime.
Thank you so much for coming on and having this really important conversation with me about the election of 1800. And
thank you,
everybody, for listening to us today.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.